Hi, this is Willie Wilson. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. It's Monday morning. I'm Beth Pike, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. This morning, we are going to have a great show for you, and I'm so glad that you have joined us this morning. It is Monday morning. It's chilly out this morning, and this is Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's broadcast, our host, Latara Smith, is going to be talking with the 26th District Representative, Brandon Ellington, and they're going to talk about a bill that he will be introducing in 2017, and that's the session that is establishing a conviction integrity unit. They were originally to be joined on the phone by Ricky Kidd, who had proven his innocence in court and is still fighting to be released after 20 years, but he can't join us today. We will be opening the phone lines later for your comments and questions, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. And there will be no calendar of events this week, but we will have our 420 drug war news. It'll all be at the end of the show. Coming up here in just a moment, though, we will have for you Latara and Representative Brandon Ellington. That's all coming up on Jaws of Justice Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio this morning. Weather has got us a little bit discombobulated, so to say. Our guest is not quite here yet, but he is on the phone, Brandon Ellington, and our host is also on the phone, Latara Smith. So this is Jeff Humfeld, and I'm going to turn it over to Latara and hopefully to Brandon. So, Latara, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Awesome.
And Brandon, are you there?
Oh, no, I'm here. How you doing?
All right, good deal. And we hopefully will have Brandon in the studio instead of on the phone here for too long.
Yeah, I'm trying to get there.
So that at the in the second part of the show, we will open the phone lines and try and take a few calls. So, Latara, I'm going to turn this over to you, and if I'm going to play a little bit of traffic cop because there is one of these weird things that when somebody's on the phone and they're talking, they can't hear anybody else. So, Latara, why don't you get started?
Okay, awesome. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in to the show this morning. I appreciate you doing so. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Representative Brandon Ellington in reference to a bill that he is submitting into Missouri legislature in reference to conviction integrity units. And for those who are listening that are not aware of what a conviction integrity unit is, it's a very, very important division of a prosecutor's office. And the Casey Freedom Project, we've been fighting for a little over 2 years for the implementation of a conviction integrity unit here in Jackson County, Missouri. And by having support of Representative Brandon Ellington as well as Senator Ryan Silvey, we now are being able to pursue the implementation of a conviction integrity unit on a much bigger level, where our state of Missouri would be, you know, impacted and most definitely positively affected by, you know, the conviction integrity unit. But a conviction integrity unit, everyone, is a division of a prosecutorial office that works to prevent, identify, and correct false convictions, okay? And it's very, very important to have, you know, lately we've had a lot of different individuals whose cases have been brought to the forefront in reference to they are innocent and wrongly convicted. And even though they have the newly discovered evidence or they have DNA results that reflect them not being, you know, the culprit, and it shows that they're innocent, they are not still able to bring up these claims of, you know, they can bring up the claims, but they're basically ignored. They're not allowed any leeway in their cases. So a conviction integrity unit would be something that would be able to offset that. You know, it's like I said, it's a unit within a prosecutor's office where we would be able to go straight to that prosecutor's office and say, listen, this is a case that needs to be reviewed. And, you know, we need your conviction integrity unit to review it. And it would help you know, and cut back on a lot of this time that individuals take up when they're fighting cases. You know, people are not aware that it can take, you know, 10, 15 years of fighting in court to try to get, to try to regain their freedom when they're innocent and wrongly convicted. So,
Brandon, why don't you tell us just a little bit about the bill that you're getting ready to introduce and why? You know, who's going to be affected? Is this something that's going to be, you know, if it's passed and signed by the governor, is it something that will be a statewide unit, or is it something that requires the counties to establish these units?
Well, it's going to, it's a multi-layer thing. So it would be statewide, obviously, the law, but it would be locally driven, too, so the counties will have to do it. Basically, what we're trying to do is exactly what Ms. Smith said, get the criminal justice system to actually be honest and concerned about not just convicting people, but making sure they're convicting the right people. And if they're not convicting the right people, making sure that we're not warehousing people that we know is innocent. There's several cases in Missouri that the evidence is highly questionable, whether the individual actually committed the crime or not, and these individuals are still locked up with no justification. And I can go through a couple of cases. One of the cases in particular is Ricky Kidd's case, which has a whole bunch of anomalies in there that should be looked at. And I actually believe that he's innocent, but he's going to serve life right now because nobody wants to look at his case. And this is something that we're seeing on the national trend, too. Like I briefly talked to Ms. Smith a couple weeks ago when I called her. On the national trend, you're starting to see the national guys pay attention to it because it's a huge concern. And Ms. Smith actually brought it to my attention a few years ago. Ms. Smith has been working on this. I don't want to mess up the years, but Ms. Smith has been working on this for a long time. And when she brought it to me and I kind of got to looking at it, I wanted to do something last year. I didn't. I called her this year and told her I was definitely going to be filing the bill this year. No ifs, ands, or buts. And we're going to try to push a heavy push. It would be appreciated if we can get the local prosecutors on board, because even they know that it's issues. But again, now we're talking about politics as opposed to actual concerns about individual lives, because no prosecutor wants to admit that their office makes mistakes, even though they know these mistakes are made. They're unwilling to come up and fight for it. But they would mention in private conversation that, yeah, we need something like this.
One of the things that I think is part of this is that most prosecutors and maybe a lot of judges feel like if there are a lot of cases like this that are overturned and stuff, it will make people not trust the system anymore. And the fact is that an awful lot of people don't trust the system because they can see this themselves. Their family member or someone they know or something has been hurt in this way, and I think it already is injuring trust in the system. Latara, isn't that kind of what you're looking at, or are there some other things too, maybe practices that need to be addressed?
Well, I totally agree with what you just said, and what really puzzles me is that when you have a case such as Mr. Kidd, you know, and I'm not going to go into detail, but, you know, just kind of what's been there in the media eye and out in social media, because, you know, his case was just on Channel 41 News. This is what I want to say in reference to it. We can clearly look and see that there is evidence pointing towards Mr. Kidd's innocence. We can plainly see that. And why, you know, no disrespect to our local prosecutor, none at all, okay? But why is our local prosecutor's office not stepping up and accepting accountability, you know, and saying, hey, you know, as good people, as a ethical obligation, we are supposed to address these issues. We have, I would say, Jackson County cases of innocence that are, I mean, this evidence in both these cases, in Ricky Kidd and Keith Carnes' case, most definitely points towards their innocence.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand why come our prosecutor's office just simply won't right wrongs, and especially in Keith Carnes' case, because they were given all the newly discovered evidence. There was a prosecutor over there in the office by the name of Dion Sanker. He reviewed the case, and to my understanding, his recommendation for Keith Carnes' case was that he needed a new hearing based upon credibility issues with one of the eyewitnesses. And so far, thus far, the prosecutor's office, now, 8-9 months later, still has not just cooperated. And I think that is, I think it's sad. Just recently, Keith Carnes' attorneys, Kent Gibson, and co-counsel Angela Silvey, have submitted a motion for Keith Carnes to have a new trial based upon purged testimony and newly discovered evidence. And thus far, there is a case management conference set on January 12th in Keith Carnes' case. But I am praying that our prosecutor, Jean Peters-Baker, will do just what she said on the news that she would do on Channel 41 when they were interviewing her about Ricky Kidd's case, or where they, she had a statement, rather. I can't say they interviewed her. But she said that, basically, I will address all newly discovered evidence. And in this case, there's most definitely tons of newly discovered evidence. It just knocks me off my feet. And we as a community, we need to pay attention. You know, if we have people in office that are not going to right wrong, then do we really want that person in office? You know, do we? That's a question that everyone needs to ask themselves. It should be about justice. And I understand the implementation of a conviction integrity unit would take a large budget and things as such. But it's most definitely needed because Jackson County has a lot of individuals who are claiming what they call post-conviction claims of actual innocence. And it's not a coincidence that they're all, you know, that several of them are right here out of Jackson County.
No, I mean, this is the problem. And this is the reason why I had to file the bill. So you get fictitious good faith comments from certain people in office that will say, well, yeah, we know it's a problem. And we're going to look into this, but there's no legislation or no forcing mechanism to actually make them look into the case. So the two individuals that she just mentioned, anybody, I'm talking about anybody, can pretty much look at their case and sort of scratching their head. Like, all right, you know, you don't have to be a law professor to look at their cases and to find abnormalities in it. The same way we look at the overt conditioning of corrections, and you actually made a statement when you said that basically the institutions are preserving themselves, right, when you talk about trust and transparency to the community. So if the institutions really want people to trust them, then I believe the institutions should bend over backwards to make sure that they're putting themselves in a position where they only care about justice. Not we care about looking like we made a mistake. No, that's actually good. If you made a mistake and you're willing to work and correct it, that's how you gain somebody's trust. Not making mistakes and then willfully hiding them because you want people to have a perception that the criminal justice system is pristine. We know that it's not pristine from sentencing guidelines, from imbiased practices and different substances and time frames that people get because of the color of their skin and all of this good stuff. We know this is a fact. And when we talk about the integrity protection union, you ask who's it going to affect. It's going to affect everybody because anybody can get convicted of a crime that they didn't do, which is scary. Anybody can get convicted. And then you got certain individuals that lives is being thrown away because of maybe the prosecutor that happened to be on that case and the ties to politics or whatever lines you want to draw, because you can draw lines in several of these cases. But the motivating factor and the common denominator is people that are losing their lives for crimes that they didn't commit, and it's enough evidence for that to be overturned. But we're all afraid of making the institutions look bad. We're all afraid of saying, well, you know, they could make a mistake when they prosecute somebody. This is how we build trust. And again, that's why I said it would be beneficial. I'm not expecting it, but it'd be beneficial if we can get the prosecutors in Missouri to actually come out and support the legislation as opposed to talking about it behind closed doors, like, well, it is a problem, but, you know, we try to do our best job. Well, if you know it's a problem, come up there and make sure that we have a union in place that can actually catch people that fall through the cracks that should not get convicted, that gets convicted off of circumstantial evidence or maybe the way they look or bad defense lawyers or whatever. We need this unit. We definitely need people to get involved, and people need to understand that anybody can be locked up for a crime that they didn't commit. And in Missouri, we have numbers of people that are doing murder deeds for murders they didn't commit, meaning we have free murderers running around these streets while we got people locked up because we want to look like we're tough on crime, as opposed to researching and making sure that we're actually convicting somebody of life that actually committed the crime of taking someone's life.
And I think that goes to Latara's comment about do we want this particular person to be in office,
yeah,
if their concern is just getting a conviction and not about finding the right person that committed
well,
the
Jeff,
crime
Jeff,
because they're still on the street.
Well, I want to be clear about it. It's not just getting the conviction. The initial thing is getting the conviction, right? So I got an individual in front of me. I think he committed a crime. I'm going to do everything I can do to get a conviction. That's not the problem. The problem is once you convict that person and evidence comes up that this person is innocent or you may have made a mistake, then you should be willing to work just as hard to make sure that you're not taking somebody's lives that doesn't deserve their lives to be taken. So it's not just about getting a conviction, because sometimes evidence comes up later. Maybe that's DNA. Maybe that's witnesses recanting. Maybe that's somebody actually committed the crime, confessing to it. All kind of weird stuff like this has happened in some of these cases that we're talking about. And there should be a unit that actively investigates it. Like, very simple. It's not saying that prosecutors are dumb. It's saying that prosecutors are human and any mistake can happen. It's not saying that all juries is vindictive or evil. It's saying that juries go off of evidence that's presented, and sometimes prosecutors keep repressing evidence, right? So it's saying that we want to have a criminal justice system that is adequate and extremely fair. And by extremely fair, we want to have faith that our officials and our commissions, the reason I say commissions because they actually create commissions, and our commissions is actually actively researching people's cases, not just probation and parole. I'm not going to get into that because I got some legislation for that too. But to make sure that our criminal justice system is actually adequately reviewing cases, to make sure our criminal justice system is adequately locking people up that deserve to be locked up and not locking people up that don't deserve to be. I mean, it's irritating. It's extremely scary. Anybody can get locked up. Nobody was here.
There is that. Latara, why don't you tell a little bit of some of the things that happened in court or some of the practices that happen that convict innocent people?
Well, I can say in the cases that I have, that I've been assisting individuals, you know, we help individuals that are working on their cases pro se. And I can actually say what I have been able to see is things that happened in the forefront of the case during the investigations. Botched investigations will lead to wrongful convictions. In a lot of these cases, we see just really, really, really horrible police misconduct, okay? And then it goes on. I've seen collaborations with police misconduct teamed up with the prosecutor who was operating in, you know, prosecutorial misconduct, and the collaboration between the two led to the individual's wrongful conviction. You know, that is most definitely something I believe if we right a wrong in a case where there's police misconduct, okay, and there's prosecutorial misconduct, then what happens is those persons are found out. You know, they've been exposed, it's been revealed what they did, and I've had a lot of conversations with people, and it's, you know, kind of the behind the door, you know, Latara, let me talk to you type of conversation, and that's what I hear. Mm-hmm. Well, if we do this, then this is going to bring out this, and if we do this, this is going to bring out that, but it doesn't matter to me, because if those people walk in a spirit of deceit and dishonesty, they need to be exposed. They need to be revealed. There's other issues like here, and I've got to say this, and you know, I'm not, a, you know, this is no disrespect to anyone over at the Office of Community Complaints, okay? I simply do not agree with their complaint process. Because many of these cases, when we found out that the police committed misconduct, just because it's past 90 days, okay, does not mean that gives the police department or those officers a pass where their misconduct is not addressed. And right now, currently, the way that their rules and regulations are written over at the Office of Community Complaints, which is under the direction of Pearl A. Fain, soon to be Merle Benekin, if I'm not mistaken, will be taking her place as she retires here shortly. But the point I'm making is, you know, any police misconduct should be addressed. Even if he found out about it 9 years later, it needs to be addressed. And this is a gray shadow that they have. I know in Keith Clark's case and another case, Mr. Clark's case, where these police officers, you know, they're not investigating the complaints because they kind of stop it and pump brakes at the fact that, oh, it's past 90 days, so we're not going to address it. When if they did address it, it would open the door, you know, for this individual to be released. I mean, I really don't think people get it. Mr. Kidd is not serving, he's serving, what, 4 life sentences, Jeff? No, yeah. 2 life sentences with no parole, and then he has the 2 ACA cases or whatever. Mr. Carnes is serving 2 life sentences with no parole, okay? We have an issue of a gentleman, Mr. Donahue, and I want to say this, too, about a conviction integrity unit. A conviction integrity unit, if you listen to the name, it is a conviction integrity unit, which means it questions the integrity of that particular conviction. And in the case of a Myson Donahue, you know, he was sentenced to first-degree murder for something that should have been a manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter charge. And he was, this young man received life without parole and charged with first-degree murder when that is not what this man should have been, you know, should have been charged with. I mean, he should not have been convicted of first-degree murder. So a conviction integrity unit will also address those cases where, you know, it's an issue. You know, maybe the person is guilty, but not guilty as they were convicted. Do you understand what I'm saying, Jeff?
Yes.
Or Brandon?
There's a group that teaches people about being on a jury and what they can and can't do and the like. And one of the things that they say is the responsibility of a juror is to protect citizens from an overreaching government, and overcharging people and stuff like that is one of those issues. All right, we're back with the Jaws of Justice radio show, and my name is Jeff Humfeld, and on the line with me are Latara Smith of KC Freedom Project and 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington. And we're talking about conviction integrity units today. And one of the things I wanted to throw out there, because it seems like this get tough on crime issue that's been in our legislatures for so long has created some of this problem. They have tightened up, so to say, or made it more difficult for someone to prove their innocence once they are imprisoned. Everything from a time frame that you got to have a certain document in by a certain time and things of this sort. And if it's 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute past that, then you're totally denied. It doesn't make a difference whether the information that you bring forward is truthful, whether it proves that you're innocent. You have to stay in jail because you didn't meet a deadline. This is one of those, you know, one of the reasons why we need these conviction integrity units. Latara, do you have anything to say about that particular part of this issue?
Yes, it's funny that you would go there because I was just getting ready to go there myself. And see, people, you've got to understand that the post-conviction process in Missouri, okay, presents a unique procedural. It presents unique procedural hurdles to the innocence process, okay, in cases involving final felony convictions. Once the time frame for the filing of a motion for a new trial has expired or any post-conviction relief, then you have to go on to doing a state habeas and things like that. And people don't understand, you know, a lot of people are not knowledgeable of the law, okay? So they may not know that they have timelines to submit things. And when they miss those timelines, the way that our justice system is set up, it's a wrap for them. You know, we have to most definitely take a look at that, because there's no mechanisms in place that would help the innocents. Right now, with the ruling of Rodney Lincoln, I mean, come on. This guy had a witness, the witness recanted. The DNA said it wasn't him. And when he filed, when the Innocence Project filed for Mr. Lincoln, he was denied because he's not serving, you know, he's not a capital case. He was a non-capital murder case. There's no place for anyone in Missouri to bring up a claim of innocence and have any relief since they came down with the ruling with Rodney Lincoln. And, you know, people need to pay attention to that, that these are things that our state legislators and everyone need to pay attention to. And really, you know, our local judges, they've got to pay attention to this, because beyond DNA motions and innocence investigations, conviction integrity review units, you know, can and should serve a proactive purpose. And this is why come we need one.
Ask you a little bit about this, the bill that you're putting forward. How does it work? What is being required if this bill passes? And, of course, we know the legislative process. Some things will maybe get changed or whatever. But the bill that you're putting forward, just what exactly is it, you know, the process going to be?
Hold on. Give me just a second, Jeff.
Okie doke. You know, I think that this is one of the main things. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. One of the main things it's kind of a straightforward process. You get somebody that got a case, they file a complaint, the unit looks into it. Most of the issues is close, right? So people are convicted, so they go back over case files, evidence, witness statements, all that good stuff. But I got a couple other pieces of legislation that actually addresses all elements. That's what I wanted to say, because, like, the integrity unit does what the integrity unit does, which goes after cleaning up cases and cleaning up people and proving that they're innocent. The first procedures, some of the legislation actually goes out with police procedures, such as the witness lineup, how they conduct the lineup, et cetera. And I got several different pieces because each piece is trying to address a systematic flaw in the system. So I don't think the integrity unit is going to clean up police procedures. However, I do believe by standardizing the way the police can actually pull people over, standardizing the way the police can actually put people in lineups will curtail some of the issues that we find when we review cases of police misconduct or even prosecutorial misconduct. As far as the prosecutor piece, I don't have any legislation that I'm filing this year that actually addresses some of the issues I just found in the prosecutor's office. But the legislation, the integrity unit will create a commission. The commission will be responsible for actively reviewing cases of questionable innocence. And basically, an inmate will have to file a complaint that they believe that their case wasn't right, and then the unit will start researching it from there. But before that, I do want to put in there that we have a bill to actually standardize police procedures. And to go to the other comment about the legislative body being tough on crime but not smart on crime, that's 100% true. However, it is the Republicans up there that actually understands the issue. So some of the legislation that they're going to help me work on addresses a lot of police procedures, such as the video and audio, the written consent form, which goes to a lot of stop and frisk and things of that nature, and the criminal, the Racial Profiling Act, which will actually put teeth into what we haven't been doing. So, like, when I heard Ms. Smith talking, she was talking about issues that we've had down here in Kansas City at the Office of Citizens' Complaint. Well, I know for a fact several individuals go down there and they never get anything justified as far as the police of doing anything illegal. In the state of Missouri, we conduct all of these numbers, right? So we know that there's in biasness and racial stops. We know there's biases and traffic tickets that are issued, et cetera. That's why we did Senate Bill 5, but what we haven't done is utilize our state numbers to actually attack cities to make sure the cities are adequately policing people. And that's what the Racial Profiling Police Act would do. It would take the numbers of the state of Missouri from unbiased police stops, arrests, ratios, et cetera, and then put weight on the cities to make sure that the cities weren't allowed to get through with unbiased policing practices, which goes all the way back to the integrity unit, because now we're starting to look at the numbers of individuals that we get locked up in the state of Missouri.
Latara, let's talk just a little bit about prosecutorial misconduct, which is not really a word. Prosecutorial is not really a word, at least not according to spell check.
Or Scrabble.
I know, right?
I will accept that.
But anyway, why don't we get into a little bit of why prosecutors maybe cheat or hold information back? Is it just because they think they've got the right person, or is there maybe something else they're involved too?
Well, you know, I can just say from the few cases I know of where for sure there was prosecutorial misconduct, it was just, they want you. Like I said, it's a collaboration, okay, between the police are committing the police misconduct, and then they team up with the prosecutor, and then they commit the prosecutorial misconduct, and they are, at that point, a dynamic duo team to wrongly convict someone. And, the different forms of prosecutorial misconduct would be, one main one we see a lot is withholding information. Withholding information that they knew if it was brought about in a case, it would most definitely, sway the case the opposite way of what they were trying to do, which was convict the individual. So you have that. Then withholding information, you have prosecutorial misconduct where they are, you know, coercing and forcing and threatening individuals to implicate someone as an assailant in a crime, which is, you know, exactly what happened in Keith Carnes' case with the former Jackson County prosecutor, Amy McGowan. Issues of using witnesses that are not credible. You know, I have found in cases that they preyed upon individuals who were, you know, dealing with, you know, maybe drug addiction or had pending cases or, you know, and those individuals, you know, were vulnerable and fell prey to being used by, you know, have been used by prosecutors to implement individuals as assailants in crimes when that actually was not, you know, the case. And when prosecutors withhold information, like I'll say in Daryl Burton's situation, if I'm not mistaken, in Daryl Burton's case, they didn't reveal all of the criminal history of one of the witnesses that they used, which is, you know, something they did in Keith Carnes' case. You know, at the time, the Don Parsons was the prosecutor who ended up finishing out Keith Carnes' case. Amy McGowan had left and went over on the Kansas side. And when Don Parsons had the witness on the stand, she only brought up four or five of her felonies. And, you know, simply just told the judge, well, I had a list, but I've misplaced it. And instead of Judge Gene Martin stopping the court process and saying, hey, I need this list, he allowed, you know, the court proceedings to go on. And, you know, years later, when I get on the case as a volunteer and we, you know, work with the eyewitness who had recanted and she cooperated with us to get access, to gain access to her closed criminal records, well, we pull up her criminal records, you know, and no disrespect to her, but she had quite a lengthy criminal history. Over 50 criminal charges were brought out, okay? And so, I mean, you think about it. If you were sitting there and you heard someone call out 50 criminal charges, what would you think about the individual that was sitting there testifying on someone? You know, you would probably not deem that person credible. I mean, so these are the type of tricks and snares and schemes that I've seen that have been happening, you know, and it's a shame. It's a shame. And what makes it even more a shame is when we don't right those wrongs, when we see that this has happened, we know that it has happened, and we don't right the wrong, and we leave innocent people in prison.
Okay. Brandon is in the studio, and we actually have a caller on the on the line, too. So we're going to go to the caller that's on the line, and that number is 816-931-5534. Don't wait, because we're getting very short on time. So, caller, what part of town are you calling from, and what's your name?
Kansas City, Missouri. My name is Tommy.
Tommy, what's your comment?
Nothing. I just got in because I just got a call that said they was on the line. So I was trying to see what we was talking about this morning.
We're talking about conviction integrity units.
Oh, yeah, they definitely need that. Latoya knows, and Brandon definitely know why we need that. And I'm one of the people that's involved in the victim integrity unit that needs it. But whatever they're saying is why we need it, is definitely why it's needed.
Well, we thank you very much. Any other comment?
Well, I want to ask, since we have Tommy on the line here, Tommy, I'm somewhat familiar with Mr. Simmons' case, and his case is also one that a conviction integrity unit would address, you know, even though he's already, you've already served your time, right, Mr. Simmons?
Right.
Okay. So a conviction integrity unit will also address a case, okay, where the person has already served time in jail, okay, but the conviction can still be, you know, addressed to the conviction integrity unit, and if the proof is there that this individual was wrongly convicted in the beginning, even though they served time, they can still correct that conviction, which is very important because we would be able to get that off of that person's criminal history, okay, and, you know, people need to also know that a conviction integrity unit could do that as well. So,
all right, Brandon, you have any comment there?
The conviction integrity unit, I don't know if I got this out when I was driving, on the back end is something that we definitely need. And the reason I say it's on the back end is because by the time people are locked up, especially people that are locked up from inconsistencies in their cases, They already went through the criminal justice system. They already went through the court system. They already went through all the systems that are supposed to have checks and balances, but we know they don't. On the way in, I heard Ms. Smith talking about some of the prosecutorial misconducts that happens between law enforcement and prosecutors when it comes to law enforcement utilizing inappropriate policies or practices when they initially stop somebody, search somebody, arrest somebody, or what have you at that initial stop. I believe that needs to be standardized and unified. People that we studied Johnny Cochran, Johnny Cochran was an extremely good defense attorney because he worked in the prosecutor's office prior to being a defense attorney. So he utilized all of the inconsistencies that we know happens between law enforcement, apprehension, and conviction. What we typically do in political criminal justice arena is we fight only for the institution. So we know that the police may have mishaps in the way they apprehend people. We cover that up because we want to have the ultimate conviction when in turn we should be working on integrity in the criminal justice system. So standardizing the police line of procedures, standardizing consent forms for when people get searched without a warrant, standardizing some of the interactions between law enforcement and definitely reviewing cases after people have been convicted should give us a more transparent system than what we have right now. And as far as retroactive going after people like Mr. Simmons that have been convicted, and I can actually speak to his case, too, because I seen the warrant. On his warrant, when I took it around to several different law professors, everybody said that it was illegal. And then they also turned around to me and said that they're not going to do anything about it because of the judge that happened to be on that paperwork.
All right. Mr. Simmons is still on the line here or back again. I think he got dropped out. Did you have any other comments on your particular case?
Well, yeah. And Brandon's true about the warrant. I mean, you know, the warrant was so, unconstitutional that it should have been thrown out. And just like you said, because of the judge and the lawyer that was involved, that was in cahoots with this, and that's what happens with your lawyer. You get lawyers that's in cahoots with the system, and they'll throw you under the bus, so to speak. But just like in the case I'm in now that just came out in the paper, in my case, we just finding out that the police officer and the prosecutor had an affair with each other. They didn't disclose the affair, and I was totally set up by both of them to get me off the street. And under the law, Jean Peters Baker, she knew that they had this affair, and she let it go on. And this is a classic, perfect case of why the integrity unit should be in implemented because of something like this. Now, I just read a case the other day about a judge and a prosecutor having an affair on a death penalty case. They had to overturn the whole case and throw it out because they didn't disclose the affair. Now we just finding out about the affair, and they concealed it. And I just got a letter from the Office of Citizen Complaints saying that they can't do anything about it because it was 6 years ago, and they don't get involved in things that, but if it's been concealed by fraud, you should never have a tolling when something's concealed by fraud because they concealed it.
That's right.
And it's just like the statute of limitations. In the statute of limitations, they say it's 5 years, but it don't say that it's 5 years. It says when you ascertain when the wrong was done, not when the wrong was done. So, and if it's concealment and fraud involved, it don't ever toll. So the Office of Citizen Complaint should have that provision in their statute or their policy that if something is concealed from you by fraud or if it was fraud, then there shouldn't be no tolling. It don't make no difference how long in time it's suspended. Because if you conceal something, hide it from the person to where he can't find out, then once they do find out, then you're supposed to pursue it.
And if I could, I want to make a brief comment real quick.
Sure.
The commission, the integrity unit, is actually going to be separated from the way that things constantly work right now. So we keep hearing people talk about the Office of Citizens Complaint. Well, basically, when you go down to the Office of Citizens Complaint, you're complaining with the same agency that you have a complaint against. So since when I take people down there, almost everybody that I take down there gets the same letter back that is non-circumstantial or non-confirmed or whatever the wording that they use. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's non-valid. So basically, what we want to do with the integrity unit is create a commission that's outside of the prosecutor's reach, outside of law enforcement, that would actually give us an adequate check and balance. And this is our major concern with the criminal justice system overtly. They have no checks and balances. If you have a prosecutor issue, lawyers take that up. If you have an issue with a judge, judges take that up. And as an elected official, we have no recourse at all when we know the criminal justice system is doing something illegal inside that criminal justice system, except to watch the criminal justice system work it out within themselves, which is extremely crazy because no other institution is designed like this, where the only checks and balances is that institution.
We are just about out of time here today. I apologize to our caller and all the other people that wanted to call in. I, like I said, it's unfortunate that the weather interfered with the way we had the show set up. We do want to thank everyone that did call in and to Tommy for calling in and those that of you that bore with us today. I guess the way I'll take this out is saying thank you to Brandon and to Latara.
I'm just glad I didn't wreck. Thank God.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, and for Tommy, thank you for your comments as well.
Okay.
I just want to remind people that, you know, the system that we have is not really about justice. It is about the law, built on the law, and we have to remember that laws are written by humans, and humans are fallible, so the system itself is fallible as well.
Can I say one more thing real quick?
All right, but hurry up.
Now, I'm going to try to sneak it in real quick. Something that solidifies prosecutor misconduct that's not necessarily illegal but definitely taints the case. If you look at the case from St. Louis with Bob McCullough, he utilized prosecutor misconduct legally by disclosing all the information, tainting future evidence. So we do have prosecutors that willfully play with the law. So please get involved. Please contact Ms. Smith. Contact me. But we need help with the integrity unit. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
It boils down to this. You know, Canada's outlining how they're going to legalize. Mexico may do the same with medical. We got Duterte in the Philippines. And now we've got the DEA wanting to rob children of the one medicine that stops their epileptic seizures. We're speaking with Mr. Robert Holbein of the HLG Holbein Law Group, the nation's premier cannabis firm. Sir, what is going on?
Well, there's a lot going on, and I appreciate you asking, and thanks for your time this morning. The DEA had come out just yesterday through a publication known as the Federal Register with a final rule. What this rule does is it creates a new drug code for marijuana extract, quote-unquote marijuana extract. So what are the implications of this? I mean, that's ultimately what everyone's been wrestling with or trying to get their arms around. At its basic level, the drug code is simply an administrative coding function that allows DEA registrants to identify certain drugs that they may or may not be using in their research or the treatment of individuals. For example, hospitals, institutions of higher learning, other private party DEA registrants like pharmaceutical companies. So on its most basic level, it's a simple administrative function. But the problem in practice is that, and we've dealt with this personally and professionally through our law firm on behalf of clients, so many government agencies, both at the state and local level, look to this coding system as gospel as it pertains to what's a controlled substance or what's not. And this definition purports to say that any cannabinoids from a marijuana plant are unlawful. That's a problem because cannabinoids are not controlled substances per se. And that's where, as you alluded to earlier, this could present some problems with people obtaining cannabinoid or hemp extracts for a variety of wellness conditions or just for day-to-day use?
We've got politicians stepping forward, Democrat, Republican, both recognizing that these cannabinoids are of benefit. They've seen the evidence.
And that's partly the problem, because if there's evidence to suggest that there's a naturally occurring substance that helps people with a variety of physical ailments, conditions, etc., then what does that tell you? That tells you there's money to be made on that product.
Part two with Attorney Hoban tomorrow. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.